Hello and welcome to Oscar Mike Radio. My name is Travis, Marine Corps veteran and your host. Oscar Mike Radio is co-produced with Sinister One Productions. What's your podcast doing? We're coming up to or right on when this show releases September 11th. That happened 25 years ago. And I had wondered for a while how I was going to do this because, in a way, this one event changed so many lives. And I had the opportunity to talk with a different kind of guest, as you will discover, who wrote a book about his dear friend's time serving during this catastrophe that happened to the American people. And he wrote the book from the pile. Neil Adams, welcome to Oscar Mike Radio. I'm looking forward to learning about the book, Michael, and your history together. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Travis. It's a privilege to be here with you.
You know, the funny thing was, I'm like, it's the 25 years. It's been 25 years, Neil.
Yeah, it flies, doesn't it?
Do you still remember where you were when this all happened?
Oh, yeah,
Really?
definitely. Yeah, I was living back in San Francisco, where I am now. I had gone to work early in the day, which is usually my pattern. I'm up early. I'm in the office early. I like to get parking. At the time, I was living in still in Marin County in Mill Valley, which is north of the Golden Gate Bridge, but my job was in the city. I was there very early. I was probably there by 6:30 or 7 Pacific time. And I was talking to a friend, colleague of mine who was working from home, and I had the radio on and he had the television on, and he said that, oh my God, that a plane just hit one of the towers at the World Trade Center. And then the second one hit, and he thought, you better leave. I mean, nothing's going to happen today. The country's at war. I was nervous because I thought, oh my goodness. I mean, I didn't, no one knew what was going to happen. And I was wanted to get back home because I had to get across a bridge, and I thought, what if a plane takes out a bridge? You know, here that could happen too. Luckily, that didn't happen, but that's where I was on that day, and was definitely wondering about Michael on that day too. So I knew I hadn't heard from him, but I knew that if I had heard something had happened to him, that I would hear about it. But anyway, so yeah, I remember that day very clearly.
Yeah, it's really strange how I remember that I was which building in my company's office I was in, what floor, what I was doing, and all of a sudden we're seeing the TVs go to, MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, all about this. And then a half hour later, there's this flood of people trying to get out of Boston. It was really surreal. As I got to know your story and the book and the reason for writing him, I was most interested in this aspect of relationships. Like, the book is about Michael Dorion, who, served up until the last. He had AIDS. He went into the rubble and dug people out, served his fellow man. And the friendship you all had, how close you all were, but also the person himself. And you were vulnerable writing the book, but there's also a vulnerability about Michael that you really communicated. Before we get into all that, though, what led you to write this book? Because this is not the normal kind of like buddy book, bro book, sidekick book, friend book, lover book that you normally read, right? This was very different. For a very different reason. I'd like to kind of dig into that.
Sure. No, I'm happy to. When I first met Michael back in 93, 1993, I used to be an actor, and I had moved to New York for a job. I was touring the Eastern States doing educational theater. And when my tour ended, I stayed in New York and wanted to live the kind of romantic actor's life. And I got a job working the graveyard shift at some pizza dive on the Upper West Side. And one day during one Saturday night at 2 a.m., a rush came in, and Michael was part of that rush. He was drunk. We were super busy, and my friend who I was working that shift with said, "Hey, you know, that guy's checking you out." And I thought, no one's checking me out. I'm running around like crazy, like both of us were. Everyone was drunk and just wanted pizza slices to soak up all the alcohol. And but then he said, no, he's really checking you out. And I looked over and saw Michael, and Michael smiled at me, and he had a little twinkle in his eye and such a great grin. And I thought, well, this is a good looking guy, okay. But I also thought he's drunk and whatever, he's just drunk. But I went over, and as I was checking on the tables, and he started chatting me up, and we ended up trading phone numbers. And I thought, this guy's never going to call me. He's never going to even remember. But he did. He called me the next day, and he first thing he said is like, "Did you think I wasn't going to call?" And I said, "Yeah, but I'm glad you did." And we were on the phone for over an hour and just really hit it off, became very fast friends. And we agreed to get together, and I wasn't sure where it was going to go because it was clearly a pickup. But as I could tell pretty quickly that Michael was a lot more experienced than I was. I was gay, but I came out very late, and I could tell that Michael had had a lot more experiences in relationships than I had had. And I was interested in him, but wasn't sure where it was going to go. And at some point, I thought, like, this guy's out of my league, but I like him so much, and I really want to be in his life, and I really want him to be in mine. And said, "Michael, I would really like us just to be friends. I don't think we should date. Can we just be friends?" And he said, "No one's ever just wanted to be friends with me. Everyone always wanted either date me or wanted something out of me, and just wanting to like me for me." And that was the basis of our friendship. And as I got to know him and learned about his early life, I thought, I have to write this guy's story. I mean, his upbringing was diametrically opposed to the way I was raised. He, was the second son of a teenage mother. His older brother had gotten into crime. He was into stealing cars and drugs. But with a teenage mother who really didn't want to have kids and was resentful for being a mother at a young age, and she felt like her life was stolen away from her. And it was a very difficult upbringing for Michael. And he, saw his older brother getting into crime, stealing cars, and saw this was a great way to make some easy money. Rode along with his older brother a couple of times. And then Michael thought, well, I can steal cars on my own. What's the big deal? And he tried to do it when he was a teenager and got caught the first time out. So his life of crime ended then and there. But the other thing that happened to him is that he was living up in the Bronx at the time. He's a native New Yorker. And he knew that there were men that were gathering in a park near him, and they were gathering to have sex. And Michael knew he was gay. And as a teenager, he snuck out of his, apartment, where he was living with his mother at times, and was hooking up with men and making money being a male prostitute as a teenager. And those types of things I just thought were, well, that didn't happen to me at all. But I knew I just had to write his story because he overcome so many adversities just in his young life. And we can talk more about that too. But when we first met, I wanted to write his life story. And as he started sharing some things about it, he said, "I don't know if I want to do this." There were some things in his past that he wasn't proud of. One of the main things being the fact that because he was a male prostitute, he got AIDS. He became HIV positive very early in the AIDS epidemic. He was diagnosed when he was 16 years old, that he was HIV positive when he was still in high school. That year was 1983. And, he didn't know quite what to do with it. No one did. I mean, the government wasn't doing anything to help find a cure for HIV or AIDS, and they basically thought of AIDS as a gay cancer and a way to kind of eradicate some people that necessarily weren't wanted. And so it was a scary time for a lot of us. And Michael, I guess, dealt with it. I mean, he luckily found a doctor who was a leading AIDS specialist at the time, and so he was able to get on AZT very early. But he also had accidentally infected someone with HIV when he was young. He was probably 19 or 20 when that happened. And when Michael disclosed that to me, he was like, "I don't know if I want to talk about my life anymore because, I'm not very proud of it." And I thought, okay, well, we don't have to talk about your life, and I can drop the idea of writing your life story. But I always kept it in the back of my mind. And years later, when
So
I discovered,
just to clarify real quick, Neil. So when you met him and started talking with him, you wanted to write right then.
oh, yeah.
The connection something about Michael said, you know what, this is a story worth writing about right then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now,
Having, a team, go ahead.
your background as an actor, where is the writing side of you come from in all this?
Well, I come from a family of writers, actually. So I have a kind of creative bent to me. My father was a journalism major. My uncle was a reporter for a local newspaper. My grandfather had written several books. I have another uncle who was in advertising. So there's all these writers that were around me, and I was always interested in it, but I gravitated towards acting and singing because I was a sickly kid. I had asthma. I was in a body cast when I was 10 years old for 2 months and had to learn how to walk again. So I wasn't athletic at all, but I had some talent, I suppose, and gravitated towards acting and singing. And that was a great way for me to maybe explore other people and understand different relationships as I was hiding my own gayness, I guess, because
Sure.
I was closeted. Growing up in Marin County at the time was not a great place for gay people. I mean, a lot of people in my schools were ridiculing other people that they thought were gay, and my skin wasn't thick enough to deal with that. So I was very closeted. But Michael's life was so different from mine and the way he embraced things. And I thought, I have to write this guy's story. It was just really interesting to me. So yeah, I was interested in writing his story from pretty much when we first met. And Michael was into it for a while, and then, as I mentioned, once he disclosed that he had infected someone with HIV, he thought, like, never mind, I don't, this isn't something I'm proud of. But I kept the idea in the back of my mind. And as our friendship went through its own ups and downs, we went through a period where we weren't speaking for about 4 and a half years.
Oh, wow.
And when we reconnected, that's when I learned that he was a first responder on 9/11. And he was telling me those stories, and I thought it just reignited the interest in me. I thought, I have to write this guy's story at some point if he'll let me. And I never brought it up again, as our friendship continued for, almost 30 years. And close toward the end, when Michael was getting sick, I asked him, I said, Michael, I would still really like to write your story and share your story with other people. And would you be all right if I did that? And he gave me his blessing. So that's what I did.
Did he tell you what led him to become a first responder, a paramedic?
Yeah, he was a veterinary technician. I mean, that was his profession. He was the only one in his family to graduate high school or to go to college and graduate college. And he studied veterinary medicine, and he specialized in exotic animals. He was a big animal person. He loved them. And when 9/11 happened, he knew Michael always knew he was going to have a shortened life. I mean, when I knew him in New York, he had already had two major hospitalizations, almost died twice while I was still living with him. And Michael thought, I have, when 9/11 happened, he thought, like, I have medical expertise. I can help these people. He had scrubs, and he knew, like, if he got down to the, it was called the pile at the time. They hadn't, it wasn't called Ground Zero until probably weeks later. But if he could make his way down there, he knew he would get past the barricades. No one would ask any questions about what his, medical, licenses were. And he saw some police officers, and they said, go meet the fire chief over there. The fire chief said, like, Michael said, what can I do to help? And the fire chief said, all these firefighters are going on, I believe it's the North Tower, and if you can go and help the firefighters by pouring saline solution into their eyes, because all the asbestos and the grit from all the debris that was from the pile, from the smoke and everything, the ashes, everything that were there, it was getting into all the firefighters' eyes and causing their eyes to bleed. So Michael was just for 24 hours on the pile with them, pouring saline solutions into their eyes so that they could, continue their rescue efforts. And Michael was up and down that place for 24 hours doing that until they discovered that he wasn't a medical doctor. He wasn't a human doctor. And, I like to joke that the cat got out of the bag, and they discovered he was a veterinary technician. And they said, you can't stay here. You need to leave. And that brought in the whole other part of his story, too.
Yeah, because he did it for 24 hours nonstop successfully and helped several, hundreds of people out. And it had to be, a little crushing when a lot crushing when he's told to leave.
Yeah, he did not want to leave. I mean, he really wanted to stay longer and do more that he could to help. And he understood that, when the fire chief said, "You cannot be here anymore." I mean, he didn't lie, but he didn't tell them the exact truth. But Zizi was chatting people up. He was talking to police officers and firefighters there. And Michael was honest about what he did. And when that word got back to the captain, they said, "It's really not safe for you to be here." But fortunately, Michael encountered a reporter when he left that next day. And that reporter interviewed him and a number of other people and just asked him what he did that day. And unbeknownst to Michael, who knew that, he was going to have a shortened life and knew that he might get sick from his time down there in the pile. And then 15 years
Now,
later,
what
go
was
ahead.
he sick before he went and worked in the pile?
He was immune compromised for
Okay,
sure. He
at that
had
time.
AIDS. Yeah, he had already, when I knew him back in the early to mid 90s, he had had major hospitalizations, from pneumonia, and other things that he had caught.
Now,
So
Neil,
his
does that mean that, he's in this weakened state and he goes down to, he had to have known that this might accelerate things if I'm hearing you rightly.
Yes, absolutely,
So he made a
100%.
choice.
He made a choice. He
Okay.
absolutely made the choice. He knew he could possibly die that day. He didn't know what was going to happen, but he thought, "This is my city. I have expertise. I know I can help in any way I can. I know I can get past the barricades." And I really think Michael wanted to make up for some past mistakes in his life, including, infecting that gentleman with HIV and other mistakes he had made. And he thought, "This is his chance to do some good for his city and help people out and maybe help out karmatically, if that's a word, to help,
What's going through your mind then when you find out he's doing all this?
Well, I didn't know it at the time.
Right,
I
right. So
didn't.
what happened when you found
I
out?
was blown. I was blown away. I thought,
Yeah.
like, I because I wondered about Michael because we weren't re really speaking at the time when 9/11 happened, and as I mentioned earlier, I wondered where he was. But I thought, like, well, Michael, I knew Michael didn't work down in the World Trade Center, and I thought if something had happened to him on that day, I would have heard at some point. Someone would have said something to me. But it wasn't until we reconnected and he told me the whole story, and I was very proud of him and concerned too. And I mean, Michael was very healthy when we reconnected, and so I could tell that he was fine. And was very proud of the fact that he sacrificed himself that way and really put his life on the line to help other people. And again, that was one of the reasons why I thought, like, this guy's a hero, and at some point I'm gonna, if he'll let me, write, share his story. So, warts and all.
Well, warts and all, but also, it, from a military side, this is what, we're taught. You, no matter what you have, you go into, you move to contact, you move to fire, you locate and close with. And it really got me as I'm learning about Michael and his story that, it appeared that he knew he was compromised. He knew he might, accelerate things, but he's like, I'm going to go anyway. And that just spoke to a deeper part of the person that I think, need to be told.
Thank you. And Michael wanted to serve. He thought, like, this is my city. People need help. I can help, and I'm gonna reach out and do what I can to help. And because of his time on the pile and the people that he met, after that, he decided to become a volunteer police officer or apply to become a volunteer police officer for the NYPD. So he continued his service for the city after that. And he was concerned whether he was going to be accepted because he had, a couple of things against him. He was HIV positive and, had AIDS. And his health was something that the NYPD would certainly look at. And he wasn't sure that they would allow him to become even a volunteer police officer on the force. But, at the time when he was doing it, he proved that he was healthy enough. He was taking very good care of himself. He was very conscientious about making sure his T cells were over 100 so that he wasn't technically had AIDS at those times. So that was something he was always working towards. And he exercised a lot. He was always in good physical condition. He took a lot of homeopathic, health remedies and things to help keep himself healthy. So that helped him get on the force. And then he also had an arrest, on his record too. And he thought that could keep him from becoming, being accepted as a volunteer police officer, but that didn't enter into it at all too. So he was able to do that and continue to work and serve the city to the best of his ability, which he did for as long as he could for the rest of his life.
Did you get to see him at all serve, or did he talk to you about when he was actually serving?
Yeah, I mean, we shared lots of stories. And when I had moved back to California in 1996, and that was one of the reasons why we had kind of a strain on our relationship because we were 3,000 miles apart and it just upended our dynamic. But we got past it, luckily. But when I would go back to visit him, I mean, he would tell me stories, and basically he was his main duties were to kind of cruise, like Central Park and make sure, break up activities like the ones that he used to be involved with when he was a teenager in the parks up in the Bronx. So if people were having sex or doing drugs in the bushes or anything like that, Michael would kind of break them up and make sure the parks were safe. But he was also helping out with security for like things like the Macy's Day Parade or MTV events, and he got to interact with a lot of celebrities, and that was fun for him to do as well. And when I would go back and visit him, he would, take me along to, do some of his desk duties. And, I would, wait for him while he was doing some paperwork and things there. So very supportive of the fact of the work that he did. And I was joking with him too, because he was a veterinary technician and then he decided to become a volunteer police officer. And I thought, like, are you going after cat burglars? Why are you doing this? So we joked about that.
What was it like when you were, for lack of a better term, riding along with him and seeing him, live in his purpose that he wanted at that time, Neil?
I just immense pride. I'm so proud of the fact of the work that he was doing, because I also went with him when he was taking care of animals. He also, would, do lots of house calls for clients of his, and you make sure to take care of them. And, that was Michael. He was a, not only a people pleaser, but someone who wanted to help all the people that came within his purview. So if it was a pet owner, if he help them take care of, their animals. As a volunteer police officer to help make sure the city was safe, help his fellow officers and things like that, and just be a good friend and be a good community person, so.
You do this, and as I understand, eventually, what he experienced during 9/11 did catch up with him, and he passed. And you started writing this book. How did the book come to you once he was gone? You started taking up the pen, or the typewriter, the keyboard to memorialize Michael's life.
It was, I mean, I had, when we first started it, probably back in the 90s, I had taken notes down and written a few things that I had kept away. And then for me, it was because I wasn't writing it, during our friendship. I mean, it was something that I kept in the back of my mind, but I wasn't sure if Michael was going to give me his blessing. And if he hadn't, I wouldn't have written the book. But it was something where I would go back and look at old emails and look at pictures and, texts and things like that, so I could remember, everything that happened and kind of put it in a chronological state. And I did tell it through my lens too. So it's also, if you want to look at it this way, it's also the story of our friendship. Even I was telling his life story, but it's, through my lens. And I know there were other things and other people had other experiences with Michael, but being someone who, wasn't romantically involved, we had a platonic friendship, and I could be very objective with all the things that were happening in his life. And I was someone who was a confidant of his, and Michael shared a lot of concerns that he had and, anger or, frustrations or wishes and wants and things, and all these things that I knew, and several conversations that we had over years. I mean, we spoke on the phone for hours at a time. I mean, hours and hours. So a lot of things were pretty indelible in my mind about what had happened in his life. And when he got sick and he gave me the permission, I started, writing things down and trying to put everything together. And it was cathartic. Some of it was fun, but some of it was hard to write too. And I had to kind of dig deep into my own life as well. And as I was exploring things and trying to understand motivations for things and his actions from his partners and the way he was treated, all those things I just tried to, put together in a way that I thought was going to be readable. So.
I want to pull back the cover a little bit, but one thing I'm trying to understand is you do this for Michael. Did his family give you any feedback about the book? Did they know about it? And if they did they, care one way or the other? I'm just curious about that. And then I'll ask the second part of my question.
Sure, yeah. No. And the reason for that is one of the things what happened with his mother, who was, who I knew, who I was, I've known her when I was living in New York, went to their apartment many times. And so, she's reached out lots of times, but she had Michael had a challenging relationship with her, very much so. I mean, she had stolen from him. She pretty much saw Michael as an ATM machine. And it bothered me how much she used Michael. And at one point, I blocked her. What happened was Michael had his liver had failed. Michael had dropped dead where he was living at the time. They called in the paramedics and they brought him back to life, but they brought him in the hospital. And when that happened, the first thing she did was she tried to get a copy of his will to see what she was going to get out of it. And that just disgusted me. And she had done other things that had just turned me off. And I thought, I have to block this woman. I don't want her reaching out to me to find out what's going on with Michael. And so I blocked her. And when I had done that, I lost contact with her, and I lost contact with her youngest son, who I was closer with, than, not as close as I was with Michael. And I wasn't as close with his older brother, who I had met a few times, but, he was in and out of jail. He had, dealing with drugs and things like that. And he'd gone through his own stuff, and his older brother, I mean, had come through a lot of his own demons too. So I was happy about that for him, but I lost contact with them. But I wanted to protect their privacy, so I changed their names. None of their names are real. They weren't the type of people that I were readers or anything like that. So none of them graduated high school or went to college. So they may learn about this book at some point, but I did protect their identity. I wanted to make sure that they were protected, if they heard about it. And they could at some point, but I don't know if they will. But I did this without
Well,
their.
the other side of this question, now that we've established that is, you come from a family of writers. Michael had friends. What was the reaction from your family, if there were any, or some of his friends when they started reading about Michael's story?
Well, I did share it with Michael's partner, who was his partner at the end when Michael passed, Aaron, who was a loving partner of Michael. And I sent him the book, and he read it. And I knew it was going to be hard for Aaron to read it, because I knew there were going to be things from Michael's past that Aaron didn't know about. And Aaron thought the book was good. He appreciated it. He said, a lot of it was hard for him to get through, but he did, and he appreciated it. And he was the only one who I was still in contact with in Michael's life. So I know that Michael had other friends that I knew that had also passed. Other friends who I wasn't really in that much contact with. I had known them, but I never had their cell phone numbers or anything like that. So I'm waiting to hear. I haven't heard anything yet. So it could still happen. But as I mentioned, I changed everybody's name, who I knew of, and just to protect their identities, so, and
Any
protect their privacy.
feedback from your family or, friends who may have read your book? I'm just curious.
Everyone's seemed to like it. They thought it was a good story. I mean, it's not an easy story. It doesn't end happily. My nephew read it, and he said he cried. A lot of people said they read it and they were emotional and wanted to ask me lots of questions about it. So I've gotten, I guess, positive feedback from everyone who's read it, and I'm appreciative of that. But I think it's an important story. I mean, I think Michael had a lot of challenges. He was dealt a really shitty hand, growing up, and he had overcome a lot of adversity. He persevered. He was a fighter. All Michael wanted out of life basically was to get married, have kids, and have a home, have a house. And that was all he wanted. He didn't want to be a famous actor. He didn't fantasize about becoming a big sports star or anything like that. He just wanted a very simple life. And even getting those things were really hard for him to achieve. And he had challenging relationships, not just with his mother, but with many of his partners who cheated on him, who were gaslighting him. He had feelings of guilt that he had dealt with his entire life. And I tried to help him overcome and see what other people were doing with him and said, Michael, you don't deserve to be treated this way. And this is what's happening. And all those things that I think are important for, other people to read too, because, if they're dealing with challenges, with relationships in their life, be it familial or relationship-wise, hopefully if they can learn something from what Michael went through to help apply to their own lives, I hope that would be a great thing too. Because Michael, like I said, he liked to fight and persevere and get over every obstacle and just wanted to have a good time and help people.
I think for me, reading, about the book, reading some expert excerpts because I didn't get to read the whole thing, is I got a sense of life is messy.
Yeah.
On a good day, on a good day, life is messy, but everybody has a choice. And throughout it all, I'm like, okay, a lot of people wouldn't have even bothered to try to serve on a police force. A lot of people ran the other way away from the pile or ground zero. And when push came to shove, when it came time for these decision points, Michael wanted to help people. Michael wanted a greater purpose. And that's what I took away from it is no matter where we are or what our life has been, Michael to me stands out as an example of you can literally do good, change the arc of your life anytime that you want to, and leave an indelible, footprint behind of what you did. That's what I got out of it.
No, thank you. I mean, thank you for that. I mean, I think that's important and something that Michael really wanted to make sure people knew about too is something that Michael needed because when he was diagnosed with stage four cancer in 2016, the cancers started appearing on the outside of his legs, and it was a mutated form of skin cancer that they were able to tie directly to ground zero. When he left the next day, he had with him like the helmet, the blanket that they gave him, the respirator, the books, and a lot of the debris from the pile that was, on his clothing. And he kept it in a box. And he wasn't sure why, but he knew it was important and didn't know what was going to happen. But when he was diagnosed with, stage four cancer, he was going to need experimental treatments to help, extend his life and hopefully, keep him alive long enough to find a cure. And he was eligible to get money from the World Trade Center Fund, but there was also the Victims' Compensation Fund. And while he was able to get the money from the World Trade Center Fund, because anyone who was affected by those attacks were able to get money from it, but it wasn't going to be enough to help him with the treatments that were going to be $100,000 a pop. And the Victims' Compensation Fund was going to be able to get him more money to afford those things. But he had to prove he was actually there on 9/11 because even though he had had what he was wearing that day, he had debris from the World Trade Center in a box. And they said, yeah, but you could have been there on the 12th. You could have been there on the 13th. We don't know that you were actually there on 9/11. But
What
when he
about
left,
that reporters?
exactly. That's what
Okay.
happened. So he remembered that he had interviewed a reporter on that day, and Michael had become a volunteer police officer and befriended a good friend of the force who was a detective whose name was Polly. And Polly said, I'm going to help you find this guy and get you this money. And so Michael didn't remember the name of the reporter or anything. Polly found out the name of the reporter who was Walter Perez, who had left New York by that time. Polly tracked him down to Philadelphia. He didn't really remember Michael because he had interviewed so many people over those days. And he said, if the footage is anywhere, it's going to be, back at that station. And Polly and Michael were still at the time going through YouTube and trying to go through keyword searches, trying to find something on their own, and they couldn't find it. And the original tape had been destroyed, but they had a backup tape at that station. And so everyone at the station, well, not everyone, but a lot of people at the station were on the hunt for this tape. And they had, hundreds and hundreds of tapes of hundreds and hundreds of hours and hours and hours of interviews of people that were down there on 9/11. And they did eventually find the footage of Michael's interview on that day. And that actual interview ended up becoming its own news story. And that news story won a local Emmy, which they gave to Michael. And that story got back to the NYPD, who ended up giving Michael, awarding Michael the Medal of Valor for his work on 9/11 on that day. And Michael was really sick by that point, too. I mean, there's video footage of him receiving that award, and his leg, he was in so much pain. And I remember him telling me, like, I don't know if I want to go because I'm afraid if I get up there on the stage and it's going to be on television, the mayor's going to be there, and I'm afraid I'm going to throw up because I'm in so much pain. But Polly and others really said, like, I'll help you through this. You'll be fine. And so Michael went through that ceremony and did that and got through it okay. And then that got back to Spike Lee, who heard about Michael's story and wanted to interview Michael for his documentary that he did on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 called Epicenters. And he interviewed Michael for the fourth episode of that. And Spike interviewed Michael. Well, Michael died 2 weeks after he'd done that interview with Spike Lee. But I forget what the point was there of all of that, but just that, I know why. So the Victims Compensation Fund was something that was really important. And one of Michael's messages is that if anyone was affected by Ground Zero, if they were in New York, south of Houston Street on that day, he wanted to make sure people knew about the Victims Compensation Fund because they're eligible to get money if they're still having health-related issues because they were exposed to all the toxins and everything on 9/11.
You complete the book and it's out there now. And there's again there's so many messages we could take from the book. How do you feel now that you've completed this and given Michael's legacy the honor it deserves?
Well, I feel honored and privileged just to be the person that was there in his life and able to tell his story. It's something that I really wanted to do. I just felt his life and his examples that he set were really important. Just a regular guy. He just came off like a typical New Yorker. I mean, if you met him, he was just seemed like a typical New Yorker. And he was someone who was just very special. I mean, people gravitated towards Michael. My parents loved him. I mean, they didn't like a lot of my gay friends, but they loved Michael. And Michael loved him too. And he was gregarious. He was funny, very quick-witted, and just a wonderful. He had such a great spirit, just someone who just wanted to have a good time, wanted people to laugh and just enjoy life. Michael wanted to enjoy life and just experience as many things that he could possibly experience. And, those types of that message, I think, is also important because even no matter what kind of a hand you're dealt in life, Michael overcame as many things as he could to try to live the kind of life that he really wanted to live. And I think that's important for people too. If you're serving your community in any aspect, if you're a veteran or someone like me who was just like joins associations to try to help the community in which I'm involved in, helping people in our lives just be. Have a better life, help them with problems that they're having. If you see a friend who needs help, just being that kind of a person, that's what I think is important. And I'm just honored to have been that in Michael's life.
So we're talking with Neil Adams, who wrote From the Pile, a 9/11 First Responder Story. And I'll have the link in the Oscar Mike Radio Show post for this book. But again, Neil, there's a lot of parallels between Michael's life and service experience as his veterans. The deep ties of friendship that you have with somebody that you know or as a friend that you serve with. Understanding that there's purpose in service to your community. And like you just said, whether it's an association, whether it's military service, being a first responder, there's a dignity and purpose in that. And then, little actions now can have a long effect later. In closing, this is out there. What do you want people to really feel and come away with when they finish your book about Michael?
Oh wow, that's a good question. I hope people will take away, I hope people will understand Michael's road to redemption, I think. I think we all have things in our lives that we're not proud about, decisions that we've made or things that have happened that, if someone was writing my biography, there would be pages like skip that part, please. I'm not, there are things that I'm not proud of, but Michael really tried to overcome all those things. And so I hope people can take away, if they're having challenges in their own lives, how to overcome them, how to get past them, if they can learn any lessons from his life, or if they're just looking for a good story to read. I mean, Michael. If you have problems or just want to get out of your own head or something for a little while, just a story about someone who was dealt a really shitty hand, as I said, but overcame that. A lot of serendipity. He met some people who really helped him find a better way in his life, which is something that Michael really wanted to do, steer towards the light, be a good person, be that kind of person for your community. And I think his example is really worth upholding. Wart, like I said, warts and all too. So even though he made mistakes and things, he was a hell of a guy. He had a hell of a life, a shortened life, but he crammed as much into it as he possibly could and just live life and just enjoy it and try to be the best person you could possibly be. Appreciate the service that, veterans like you and other people have done. But, even if, other people who aren't necessarily veterans, but still serving their communities in other ways, that's valuable too. And Michael
Absolutely.
wasn't a veteran, and but he was a civilian who rose to the call. And for that, I'm very proud of him for that, and I'm glad I can share his story.
Absolutely. And it wasn't lost on me that, hey, I'm going down there and this might have a negative effect on me, but I'm going toward the danger. And I think, as a veteran myself, I can do nothing but respect that. Neil, I just want to thank you for coming on and sharing with me. This has been a really like this really, fit what I wanted to do for the 25th anniversary of 9/11. And Neil, as I close this down, I think of the scripture verse that says, there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, and you're that friend, and you embody that. So again, just thank you so much for sharing with me. Thank you so much for reminding us what it means to be an American, and again, the purpose of service. And I appreciate what you did.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Travis. I appreciate the work you're doing too. And thank you so much for having me on your program. I really feel privileged to be on it.
Absolutely, 100%. I'm going to have again, folks, the link to From the Pile in the Oscar Mike Radio Show post. You can get it anywhere books are sold. Neil, again, thank you very much. And I don't want to be, end on a humorous note, but I hope for Michael's sake, go Knicks.
Go next.
Their service in a deeply personal way by sponsoring a $17 Veterans Wreath. Each wreath is more than a symbol. It's a heartfelt tribute to the heroes who served and to the families who carry their legacy. Visit wreathsacrossamerica.org to sponsor a wreath today. This isn't just a wreath. It's a personal gift to an American hero.
Thank you for listening and watching Oscar Mike Radio, where our active duty service members and veterans are in action and the mission is in flight. Oscar Mike Radio is an Oversized Load Coast Sinister One production. If you are a veteran or know a veteran who needs help, please dial 988 and press 1 for the Veterans Crisis Line.